That's not quite the song that Stephen Wallace sung throughout his career. West, of course, was Scray, and like many of old football songs, there was a notion of losing nobly, but basically it was a pretty similar refrain, played not irregularly throughout Stephen's career, but I think he's got a feeling, I've got a feeling, and everybody's got a feeling that his son might one day get the opportunity to sing that. The best way of all after a premiership, because this team they're putting together is a beauty, and it's a great way to start, isn't it, Stephen?
Fine, it is. It's pretty exciting times for us.
And it's Jeff Poulter, Steve. I remember Finey was just talking about song, and I remember Kelvin Templeton saying something about, you know, we had the song about if we win or lose, you know, we had to get rid of the negativity in the song.
We also referred to 54, which was the only premiership, so... They did change a few of the words, and it was coincided when we changed to the Western Bulldogs. So it's a song that we sing now, so we like it anyway.
You know, there's something about that song, the actual Sons of the Sea, I think it is, and it was sung by Hawthorn as their club song in the club, Stephen, that the Doggies never sung it properly, because the actual song goes... Let's say it was your song, Sons of the Scray, bobbing up and down as we go. And you're supposed to say bobbing up and down as we go throughout it, but I guess that was lost somewhere on the way to the Western Oval.
I've got no doubt.
We'll start in the present, because Mitch has just returned from a short injury layoff, and nobody at the Bulldogs, including Mitch and yourself, was anything but distressed, I'm sure, when the news came out that Tom Liberatore was out for the season with a knee injury. But it meant for a number of players, including Mitch, a step up in responsibility in the midfield. And, I mean, that injury aside, he started the season wonderfully well, and I'm sure he'll be back, as he showed in his comeback game, to full form probably this week. It's a real... under Beveridge, it's been... For many players, a rebirth, and I think it's the actual birth of a champion footballer for Mitch.
It's been a big transformation in the last 4 or 5 months, as we're all, and it's been well documented. But going back to Tom, Mitch and Tom played footy, and I coached them as juniors right through. And listen, he was a terrific player as a junior, Tom. And, you know, it was probably heart-wrenching when he went down, because he could have been enjoying, you know, his football was blossoming from last year. And then to have this new spirited way that Luke has got the team playing, and with that forward momentum, and probably all the kids have come on further. But it would have been terrific to see Tom in there, because I think still we lack... some of the harder midfielders in there. You know, we've got a few outside, and he's throwing a few of the bigger bodies through there. But Tom would have been very, very handy at the minute, you know, in their pursuit of getting to the finals.
Speaking of the minute, it's pretty cold in Melbourne tonight, rainy. And I reckon where you came from, Leon Gather, tonight, down in South Gippsland, well, they'd almost be wearing suntan cream, because it probably gets even colder, much colder than that in the winter.
Colder and wet.
Yeah, real wet.
Also, we used to always love playing in the middle of the turf wicket in the middle that sort of spread about the 50-metre square. So, yeah, there's always a fairly damp area down in the Gippsland area. But, listen, it was a great place to be brought up.
Stephen, you know, I know he's a tagger and you tagged a bit. But as he was developing, did you see any similarities between the way you played and the way he was playing?
A lot of people probably... I ended up a halfback flanker and a more defensive player, but when I first played, I was a very freelance centreman for the first 3 or 4 years. And then Mick Malthus changed my game, and I ended up tagging for a period of time and then became more defensive naturally, and then drifted back to a halfback flank. If you recall, back in that time, Terry Wallace was also recruited to the Bulldogs. Mm. So they felt that they probably had the best of both worlds, because I could fulfil a back flank role or a wing role or a back pocket role, and complemented by Terry playing in the middle. So that probably prolonged my career, because in the early stages I could play most games and not get any dirt on the knees or any and get fairly wide and get 30 possessions quite comfortably. I was fairly fit in those days. So, but the change came about when Mick wanted me to play on some of the better players. We were also getting knocked around a little bit and beaten. So the idea was to inhibit a couple of their better players or their major player or ball winner. So that was my role. So it's not a great role, by the way. I didn't love it. But I think most players these days are experienced that they have to be quite defensive and or an element of the game has to be defensive, so or they won't survive. You know, I think there's probably plenty of illustrations of players that are more of an outside player or a ball-winning player, but if they haven't got that defensive skill now, they're not going to play a long career.
It's fair to say that Stephen Wallace burst onto the football scene. Round one, 1983, 25 possessions in your first game, and it was a debut that, even though you were only 18, had been delayed because of a broken leg and that Footscray and the football world were expectant of. It explain to us and the listener, if you could, Steve, how you were set back for a year and how it just built up the anticipation.
Probably goes back, when I was 16, I was recruited to the Bulldogs, so it's quite young. I had to leave home at 16. And the Bulldogs put me through Trinity Grammar, which was something that I'm indebted to, because it was a change from Lingapa High to Trinity Grammar, no doubt. But also, we went through the under-19 program with several other players at that stage. It was probably driven by Royce Hart, who had, you know, success at Richmond in developing younger guys. So coming down at 16, there was always probably an expectation of a few of the guys that were recruited at that stage that they would be ready to play in their 17th year or 18th year. Unfortunately, I'd played 7 games with the reserves in 1982 and I broke my leg. And that was unfortunate because I was probably on the verge of getting a game that year. But standing out for a year, I probably developed a little bit further with the body size and doing a few more weights and was well prepared by, you know, the start of 1983. So it worked out very well. But I think it was probably programmed from 2 years prior.
You mentioned Royce Hart, and there was criticism of Royce Hart and some other great players that they were so great that they didn't understand why ordinary players weren't as good and they didn't know how to do anything about it. Did you have much to do with Royce Hart? Did you get the chance?
I did. He had a... Listen, mainly because he really did think of investing in the younger guys, so he did probably treat us very, very well. Yes, there was no doubt that Royce was... I broke for Richmond when I was a kid, so I did know how he used to play. He'd train and train as well as anyone on the training track when he came out to the Bulldogs as coach, so... Listen, I think there is some merit to not always, if you're a champion player, you're going to make, you know, the best coach. But as we're well aware from coaches today, they come from all walks of life and all experiences. As long as they've probably played a little bit of football, it's, you know, they can make good coaches, even if they're not, you know, champion players.
1983, you finally make that debut. It was anticipated. I think, I imagine you were slated to be the youngest debutant for the Doggies, probably since Alan Stoneham, and so they love a youngster down there. Your debut, yeah, Stephen, was interesting in that 6 players made their debut for the Doggies that day.
It was a big transformation that year, no doubt. We had we recruited a lot of players from Western Australia. I actually played on Paul Armstrong from Geelong the first game, so you've probably spoken to him on the program at some stage. But yes, Brian Royal was his first game. There was many other new names to the list. It was when Shane O'Sullivan had taken over at the club as well. So there was a real push at that time for the club to look outside of just homegrown talent. And, you know, we had some reasonable success after that too.
Well, success would come within a couple of years in a preliminary final that set hearts a-fluttering. And unfortunately, preliminary finals have been the theme probably thereafter, because in 85, you were the real deal. But the seeds were planted in 83. In fact, after that first game and a loss, 4 wins in a row, and the unfashionable Doggies were up and about. It must have been pretty exciting for a young player to be part of a side that had an entire, not just suburb, side of town buzzing.
It's quite interesting when you look back, because I'd been used to winning as a junior footballer and even in the under-19s that you're used to winning. So it was quite normal in some aspect. Yes, it was great that you're part of the senior team, but I think as a junior, you know, I played in a lot of successful teams, so you're sort of used to winning. You actually get disappointed when you lose. So, but you know, later in that year, it got a bit more difficult. So when we started to lose some games, the biggest thing is not to accept it, I suppose. And I think over the time, the Dogs have at times been seen or expected, you know, that they're probably not going to perform as well as they should.
Look, there was something very special that year, and it was the game that really got the joint jumping. It was a magnificent victory over the eventual Premiers Hawthorn at Princes Park in round number four. This is one. I must do this. This is the Hawthorn team. Ayres, Brereton, Buchanara, Byrne, Ede, Russell Green, Ken Judge, John Kennedy, Loveridge, Lee Matthews, Chris Mew, Moncrief, Kelvin Moore, O'Halloran, Ian Payton, Colin Robertson, Peter Russo, Peter Schwab, Michael Tuck and Terry Wallace. That is one of the great football sides ever to step out on a field. Honestly, there's not anything but a very good champion amongst them, and you beat them.
It was quite interesting talking to Plough, or Terry Wallace, as he's known. He was knew that we was playing the Bulldogs, and I was going to be playing on him. And he was at the club, and he had to get out a couple of videotapes because he didn't have a clue who I was. So it just showed you even the professionalism of him back in those days. He had no idea who I was, so he actually had to get a couple of tapes because he'd never heard of me. Naturally, we played on each other that day, so...
It's an amazing thing. Your team included Stephen Knight, Terry Love, Brian Perrin, Ian Williams, Chris Burton, Mark Kellett. I'm not saying that these aren't great, good footballers. They're all league footballers, but this is one of a great effort by the Minnows against Hawthorn. It's a famous victory.
Yes, it is. Actually, we had a couple at Princes Park. I know even playing Carlton over the journey when they had some champion teams, we actually had some success at Princes Park.
You mentioned about getting dirty before, and I know you started in the centre and you played there for a while, but you know, you were basically a neat, clever, skillful player. I emphasise neat. Did Malthouse, when he changed you to becoming a tagger, did he feel that he wanted that you weren't rough and tough enough? Did he want to sort of change the way you play?
No doubt. But I don't think I was singled out as one of those. I do recall at that time at training, we'd... Mick in his way would put the ball between 10 metres between two players and say, go. And that's no joke. It wasn't a joke. That's how we actually trained. And I soon learned how to get off the mark fairly quick and actually get my body shape around a bit onto the side and gather the ball. But I think that after doing that multiple times, you learn to probably put your body inside. The other player that had a big influence on me back at that stage was Brian Royal, who was a player that could play inside the contest and was a very, very good rover in a tight, confined area. And I remember him early in my career saying that I'd get one beautifully on the outside and he'd get five out of the middle inside. So I soon worked out that five was better than one. And I know with young footballers these days, I'm involved with the under-18s Metro team this year as a senior assistant. And it's the one talent that I want to teach some of those kids is that most of them are very good, skillful outside players, but to play league football, you need to be able to win a contested ball inside. So Brian Rawls had a lot to do with it, and so did Nick Malthouse.
And Brian Rawls started on the same day as you, and I know you say that he plays inside more, but he is a similar sort of neat, clever, skillful player as yourself. You know, I always felt he was.
He was a terrific player. Listen, well regarded at the Bulldogs, and I think you know, he showed his talents in state football. But there wasn't. He won the best and fairest in his first year at the Bulldogs. But he was a champion player.
Speaking of champion players, when Mick Malthouse was doing the media rounds prior to breaking the coaching record, the question, of course, was asked of all the hundreds. Probably getting on to maybe even, no, it wouldn't be thousands, but hundreds of footballers that you've coached, who stands, if any, as the best? And everybody expected a sort of politically correct answer, but he named somebody. He named Dougie.
Yeah. Well, I played more games with Dougie than any other player, so I knew him fairly well.
Yeah.
And it was a fairly handy player to... He used to, if you recall, and the listeners, if they recall, we used to use him on a kick-out at the Western Oval for nearly every kick-out, and it'd be a one-on-one competition. And he marked, I would say, more than 60 or 70% of them. And I knew when he went for those marks, I would be about 15 metres away calling for a handball because he was going to get most of them. So, and vice versa, Doug used to get a fair few off me because I... so we used to work fairly well up and down his wing. But I think what Mick was alluding to, a guy with such natural skills on both sides of his body, but also he could play in any variety of positions. And I've seen him have 8 kicks and 3 handballs and nearly be best on the ground, and that sort of epitomised what sort of player he was. You know, he didn't have to accumulate 30 possessions. He actually had the ability to destroy opposition just with, you know, the few handballs and kicks that he had. And his marking was exceptional.
For the benefit of audiences at Sportsman's Night, he says he was truly amphibious, but of course ambidextrous is what he was. And he also bounced the ball in either hand, which is something that no very few players do, but it afforded him the great advantage of wrong-footing opponents and sort of goose-stepping by proxy.
Yeah, he had a beautiful step on him. But yeah. It was all natural, though. A lot of footballers that we have today can train skill into themselves, you know, and bouncing either hand, kicking, marking, doing all different types of things you train to do. He was just gifted enough that he possessed that talent naturally. And, you know, there's not too many footballers you can say that about.
And he had the peer group recognition. Opponents really admired him, didn't they? I know fella said to me that he was very difficult to beat in one-on-one situation, as you mentioned. The other thing about him was that he had that cruel knee injury in 86 when he, and unfortunately, he was probably a 90-plus player, wasn't he, before that?
Yes.
And after that, he's probably just an 80-plus. Well, when I say just, he's still a good player, but he did lose a little bit, didn't he?
No, there's no doubt about that. That was a fairly serious knee injury too. You know, as in, he had to work right through that, which was, naturally, it's always difficult coming back from a reconstruction. But, yeah, I've got no doubt that affected. He had a lot of pace as well. He was quite a quick player. Didn't look quick, but he was quick.
You know, Stephen Wallace is our special guest this evening, former Bulldog captain, 261 games and just a wonderful footballer. Stephen, I often refer to you on my program because I believe you're the best exponent of a particular skill that is now outlawed in football, though it was tried on by Stephen May earlier in the year. I've said it to you before. I guess you executed one of these on Trevor Barker. It was totally fair at the time. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. Yeah, listen, that wasn't. I've got fairly short legs, and I'm a bit bigger in the bum. So it was probably quite. It wasn't something that I intended to do, which was bump into players that way. But it was probably a style that I had that I came in fairly low. I always straddled the ball, and if there was an opponent on the other side, they either got part of the hip, part of the arm, part of the shoulder. It happened a few times.
What we're referring to is sadly lost to the game because it requires great courage to execute, and when done properly, the executor walks away unharmed, and the executed is just that. It's called a shirt front, and it was never done with malice, and incredibly, I remember that day distinctly with Trevor Barker, loved, as you know, by St Kilda supporters. We wanted to murder John Georgiadis a few years earlier for accidentally kicking him, but not one person in the crowd, I remember, took umbrage at what everybody noted was harsh but fair, and I think Barker said as much when he regained consciousness a week later.
Yeah, it wasn't quite the same on the field when I had Burnsy, Cunningham, Mace telling me they were going to knock my block off after it, but... Listen, I never had intent of probably really hurting someone, but it was part of the game and you know, the physical
Absolutely.
Side I actually didn't mind doing. But naturally, having Mitch play and my other son Josh playing these days, I'm quite comfortable with the new rules. I think it's we're headed a long way in the right direction.
It never ceases to amaze me that there were incidents where a smaller player could unload a bigger player in those days, and as Viney alluded to, inferred that it was the shirt front technique that you applied was probably the key to it. Gary Wilson and Jimmy Jess was another one that I saw.
Yeah, I remember Brett Heddy. I did. It happened once, and I just bumped him over. And Nick Mouldhouse took umbrage to it, and he was coaching West Coast. And he walked up to me after half time, and he was giving me a bit of a mouth. And I said, "You taught me everything I knew." He just looked at me and smiled and walked off. So
I don't look at this as a sad time. I think it's a good time, and I've enjoyed my time. And yeah, you actually get the boots and you do hang them up, and that's my time now. So I appreciate everything, and I'll support you blokes forever.
And true to his word, Stephen Wallace has done just that. That was in the Year of the Dog, that revealing then video, I guess it's a DVD now, but program and documentary. Steve, actually, what did you think of the Year of the Dog when you saw it back?
It's listen. I think it gave a really good feel for what the inner sanctum of a footy club was like at that point of time. It was real. It was honest, and depicted probably the different ups and downs through a footy season. And I think the guys did a terrific job on it. Listen, it was something that was quite foreign to us. We had cameras around in the change room most of the time, but it was very, very well put together. Listen, I've heard of a lot of people watched the show that weren't even football followers that actually got something from the show. So I think it was an excellent. It's good viewing, and I think it worked very well.
And Alan Joyce was the coach during that period. All your coaches were really strong personalities, weren't they?
I think most coaches have strong personalities. I've had a few. So I think I had Royce Hart, Bluey Hampshire.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, and then Mick Mouldhouse, and then on to Alan Joyce, Terry Wheeler, and Terry Wallace. So there was a few personalities amongst those.
Yep.
There were a few coaches amongst those. The one constant about the Doggies was not lack of stability, but the lack of tenure at the Bulldogs that preceded you with Quinlan and Templeton leaving. And there was always sort of a notion that if there was a good Bulldogs player, there might be a wealthier club that could lure him out of the kennel. Your loyalty was based on what, Steve? Because you had to be loyal to stay.
It was probably, I'm a country boy, and when they first came down to recruit me, it was quite specific what Dad was after. I was 16 years of age and quite comfortable down there, by the way, so coming down to Melbourne was a fairly big move. But I recall Grant Oppie, and you might remember, he was actually the football manager at that time. He suggested that he'd put me through a good school, so Dad more or less said to them, can you put me through the school, but we won't take any money? And Grant Oppie agreed to that without confirmation from the board. And he had to come back down here and sell the story to the board. And he committed to us that he was going to. And they sort of looked at it and balked at it a little bit, but then agreed to it. So that actually has led to an accounting degree. The last 2 years of Trinity Grammar led to an accounting degree and a businessman that is quite comfortable where I'm at in business. So that opportunity would never have existed unless the Bulldogs had have backed me in as a 16-year-old unproven player. So I'm always going to be indebted to those that board at that time and Grant Oppie. And to give me that sort of experience and also... And I think one of the things Dad said at the same stage, I said, well, what happens if after 12 months it doesn't work? And he said, well, just come home. And I thought that wasn't a bad outcome either. So going into it with open eyes, but them taking a punt on me without any question, I just thought that was fantastic, and I'll always be indebted.
Well, you mentioned Grant Oppie and Shane O'Sullivan, and Tony Capes was a capable president.
He was.
So during that period, I mean, Footscray's had its moments administratively, but you seem to have had a reasonable administration during that sort of early to mid-'80s, that period, didn't you?
We've had good administrators right through. We've had good players right through and good coaches during that period of time. You're quite right about mentioning about the tenure. And unfortunately, with the performance varying somewhat. We're always judged on the performance, but you also got to look at the financial side of the club, and it's been a challenge for many, many years. And you said about some of the more senior players leaving. I'm not sure of the... I was never in those rooms, but I've got no doubt some of those must have been financial reasons. One, whether we could afford or whether we're going to get something in return.
Something in return, I think.
And the viability of the club, no different to any business. There's some hard decisions have to be made. And it has been quite challenging. We've had very, very good administrators come through and actually get the stitch after a while because it is such a challenge. It's not a task that everyone puts their hand up for. And I'm a big supporter of Peter Gordon. Yes, I've been through two stints with him, the first stint and the second stint. You know, and his passion and loyalty to the club is unbelievable. But he does need support from others. And, you know, it's been a bit thin with the others at times. So, you know, that's always left us a little bit short. The same with the coaching side. You know, we've been probably over the years been limited with the amount of assistant coaches and other people to assist. That's not so much the case these days, by the way, but in the early stages, you know, we were probably undermanned in the helpers as well. So there's no doubt that had an effect on, how we performed on the weekend and sort of for the year.
It's a sad fact that the Doggies have played in 10 preliminary finals for only one win. That was in 61, where they'd go on to lose to the Hawks in the grand final. Two of those preliminary final losses you played in, Steve, and just in the build-up to those games, was there a real, not added pressure, but was there a desperation amongst fans and well wishes, please get us into a grand final, I'm not going to live forever?
I think, I can only probably give my own opinion there. You nearly felt a little bit privileged you got that far rather than expected to win. And I think even the supporters in that were the same vein until you lost, naturally. But we often were put in a position that we'd had a reasonably good year. And then you got to that last final stages and you're actually overwhelmed by actually getting there. And there's been a lot of good teams, as Geelong, Hawthorne, and of later Sydney, that they go through those preliminary finals and lose some of them as well. But they have the resilience or the foundation or the people or the staff and also the players to actually have a couple of cracks at it. And as soon as they crack that open, they actually know how to win. And I think that's significant.
You get a sense that when, and I really do mean when, this young group gets onto that stage, that history won't mean a lot to them. I can't imagine Marcus Bontempelli or Tom Boyd, and certainly not the likes of Stringer or Dixon or Cramery, worrying about the history books when they step out on preliminary final weekend, which you have to do to make a grand final now. There's no straight route because, gee, they are... I think it's confidence that's already taken them a fair way and might take them the whole way.
They're not unlike the Bombers when they had all the young players. You would hope that they have success reasonably quickly because you would hate to see that dissipated over time and we did end up more like the old days. I think they're well and truly on the right way of getting a good group of young players at the right age that will all develop and learn how to play with each other. They will need success to carry that forward. So, you know, even the balance of this year, you'd want to see them perform well for the remainder of the year. They don't need to drop off. And I think the window is the next couple of years where they've got plenty of energy and plenty of excitement about the way they play, where you could pinch a premiership or you could pinch a preliminary final or a grand final, and we just need to make the most of those next few years. We do lack a larger player, as you're well aware. In the ruck, we probably need some support, but the nucleus of good young players that are very, very fit, they have a very, very good game style now that it's the transition's moving the ball forward rather than backwards. And I think, you know, the players are confident.
Back on that 85 preliminary, and, you know, we've had Doug Hawkins and Brad Hardy talking about how you had your chances that day and you were lucky. But a lot's been talked about it, but your own memory, did you feel that you were, when you go back over it, were you actually unlucky on that day, or was it just the way it went?
I think we were beaten by experienced players in Hawthorn that were accustomed to that sort of games. I didn't have a good game myself that day, and you know, the lead up games were very good. So I think if you look at half a dozen or eight players that didn't play to the level that we had been enjoying for most of that year, we finished on top of the ladder that year. So I think we were found out at the last hurdle. And it passes so bloody quick. You know, to think that game just passed, and you know, you often reflect that it was the most disappointing game that I played in, because of you felt that there was, you know, we were better than that. We actually had success against Essendon that year on three occasions, I think. So we were their bogey team. Hawthorn actually belted us in a final prior to that, but we had their measure on that preliminary final day. But all we needed was a little bit more effort from I reckon half a dozen would have, you know, put us in that position.
Later in your career, in 1994, there was one more opportunity in the finals. It was a final eight, and it had sort of a weird way of working itself out. They had a different method. You would lose, and you were one of the best players that afternoon, to the Cats by less than a kick in that first final. And they went on to play in the grand final, because so important was that game to the final, how it broke down. I guess that was that one last chance. And it was a pretty brave... Yeah, it was a pretty brave effort till he got the ball in his mitts.
When, once again, you reeled off some names at the Hawthorn team back in 1983, and we played against some sensational Carlton teams. When you look at some of the players in that Geelong team, and I've seen a replay of that game in the last couple of years, and there were some, you know, Gary Ablett was playing in that team, you know, Couch, Bairstow. There were some very, very, very talented players. I think we were playing a style of footy once again on exuberance and youth to a point, and that holds you in good stead until that final bit. So, once again, I think we faltered because of that same reason, that you know, we were up against a pretty bloody experienced team.
And on to your last game for the club. It was round 22 in 1996, and that would be the last game, at least for the time being, that Footscray would play in the top grade.
Yep.
They would become Western Bulldogs the year after, and I think it's almost... There's a nice full stop there to your career, because you were Footscray through
fitting.
And through. Fitting it was. Mm. You were clearly the most experienced doggy that day, and you haven't lost your love for the club, whether they're Footscray or the Western Bulldogs. My one last question is, though, as good as you and Brian Cordy, certainly, and Tony Liberatore and Mark Hunter and various others were at football, you're also very good at something else, and I don't know whether... They'll change the rules to the father-son, because they're thinking of doing so, but luckily they didn't do it in your day, because, by God, you were good at fornicating and making boys.
listen, it's pretty exciting actually watching the boys play, and you know, your son play. It's quite challenging actually, because you actually worry about it more than probably when you did play. But I think I'm a big believer in the father-son system. I hope they do settle it down and actually come up with a formula that is fair and reasonable. But there's nothing more proud than to have my son wear that jumper. And I know that might be a bit of nostalgia, and that people may not hold the jumper in the same regard these days as probably the past. But for him to have that jumper on him when he runs out there, I tell you what, I still get the same feeling that I did when I wore it. So I would hate to see that dissipate, or players get randomly put into other teams when their father or was representing that team for a period of time.
They are, the father-son is an ode to the past. It's unique to Australian rules football. Mm. It is creates lineage, and for the fathers, as we heard from you, Steve, a source of great pride, and they're also great fun to make. So keep it going, I say. And Steve, I know I've got a little message from you from a bloke that calls you a sweetheart. You know exactly who I'm talking about.
Yep.
And I'll tell you what, if Mitch and the boys keep winning, this bloke will explode. So win the flag and let poor old Gilbo finally just have that emotional outburst that we all know he's going to have. How good will he be that night?
Russell was following us through, and he was a friend of Doug's naturally, but he followed us right through our career. And I've never, there's a handful of people that have been supporters of you as an individual, but also the Bulldogs that really have had an impression on me. And I'd have to say Russell Gilbert's one of those. And it wouldn't matter whether it's rain, hail or snow, or you've got beaten by 100 goals. He would stand by you through thick and thin. And you know that behind him from your day. He's one of the most loyal men. And also the warmth and support that he's shown me and my family. And so, I'm not close to him, but I actually know him very, very well from the football days and also when we catch up. And, he's a gem.
One word to finish. He taught me this word. He values it, and it describes you as a Footscray or Western Bulldogs footballer and person perfectly. We finish with the word staunch. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
Thank you.